to this episode of the Upwards Podcast, where we discuss the intersection of Christian faith in the academy, church, and marketplace. In this episode, Cam Anderson, S.L. Brown Foundation Senior Advisor, sits down with Scott Cairns, a poet, essayist, and translator. He is the author of 10 poetry collections, and his poems and essays have appeared in Poetry, Image, Paris Review, The Atlantic Monthly, and The New Republic. His work has also been anthologized in multiple editions of Best American Spiritual Writing. Cairns is the curator's Distinguished Professor Emeritus at the University of Missouri, the founder of Writing Workshops in Greece, a Guggenheim Fellow, and a recipient of the Denise Levertov Award. We hope you enjoy this episode of the Upwards Podcast.
Scott, it's a pleasure to have you here at Upper House.
It's a great pleasure to be here. Thanks.
I have a number of questions, at least to get our conversation going, but I thought I'd start with one kind of practical and less about your own work as a poet, but maybe taking you back to years that you've been a teacher of creative writing and literature. And so, practical question, if a high school junior or senior and her parents approached you and they wanted advice about whether or not their daughter should enroll in a college or university creative writing program, especially to study poetry, what advice would you give to them?
Well, first I'd ask a question. Why would she want to do that? And then, depending on how that was answered, I'd either encourage or discourage.
Is there a good or better answer to that question for her than a bad one?
Yeah, I'd say the less good answer would be that she has so many great ideas that she just feels she feels called to share with the world. I'd say, well, there are a lot of other things you might do with that, but I don't think poetry is for you. I wouldn't say it like that, but I wouldn't encourage it. But if the answer were, I just love books, I love words, I love to read, I love to write, I love messing with language, I love a good pun, you know, if somehow language is involved and a love of language is involved in the response, then I'd say, yeah, by all means. Because you can always find something else to make a living doing, as I have done. If I had to live on my royalties from my poetry, I would not be alive.
That presses the point. So here at UW-Madison, we have lots and lots of bright students, and they might be interested in these kinds of subjects, but they say, wow, I don't want to take on all that debt and spend all that time for something, and there won't be a job at the end, and their parents are worried about the same thing. And so it seems to me, you know, in the decades that I've gone by, that where this felt more like an option for students to go into poetry and art and music, that it seems very unreasonable to them, and so they sort of let it go.
Yeah, well, the idea of a liberal education, is probably falling to the wayside, but because especially now, I think young people think that they need to find a career, whereas when I was a kid, I just wanted to find something that I liked doing and something I loved doing, and so I pursued it. And then what, I had to pay bills? Well, I took a job as a cook, first as a dishwasher, then as a cook. During my entire undergraduate career and all of my undergraduate and most of my graduate career, I worked in restaurants as a cook. And, you know, if I hadn't managed to get a job teaching, I probably would still be running a restaurant somewhere.
A chef, yeah.
And being happy. Uh-huh. That's another kind of making that makes me joyful.
Yeah.
And the language and food, two things I love messing with.
Yeah, that's great.
My point, I think, was meant to be that a liberal education, regardless of what you end up doing, makes that life in which you're doing it richer, regardless of how directly applicable those studies end up being to what, you know, how you make your living.
Yeah.
However you make your living is going to be more joyful if you have this sort of base note of joy involved with how beautiful the world is and the arts. And humanities. And
so there is something, a sense of loss, I think, these days.
I would register a sense of loss if that absolutely does go off the radar for all our...
Besides just the, you know, the cost, the big financial investment of that kind of a degree in the arts or the mm-hmm. humanities, you think there's other reasons that these programs have fallen off in terms of interest or university commitment to hosting them? Or
well, they haven't fallen off in terms of interest as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
We always had more applicants to the creative writing programs that I've taught in than we could handle. Our undergraduate courses in creative writing were always full. My graduate students, we put them to work, which mitigated their own tuition. We put them to work teaching undergraduate creative writing courses. Even this low residency program that I have recently been directing has always had more people apply than we could handle. And, you know, it varies from one genre to another from year to year, but they've always been plenty of takers. And these are people, these low residency programs are for the most part designed to accommodate persons in careers. And they see writing as something they always wanted to do, but their parents discouraged their doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to go into another career. But
right.
They always wanted to be writers. So now in their, you know, they have lives somewhere or other, and they can't really uproot those lives to go do a residential degree somewhere. So we have these low residency programs that those people can enroll in and do their work, remain at home, take care of their families, do their jobs, but then, you know, squeeze in during their weeks.
They find a way.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're very popular. And even these days, I was surprised how many persons right out of college we had coming into our grad program. Because they're really not designed for people right out of college. Those people usually are flexible enough they can go to a residential program somewhere. But.
So that leads me to another question. So you've spent your life writing poetry and teaching it, and it's interesting to hear about folk who want to pursue this, right? Like during college and afterwards. What place do you think that poetry has to play in our current social, political, spiritual environment? In other words, if you were to make the case for poetry, which I suppose you often get asked to do, what's the case for it these days?
Yeah. Well, Cam, you may have forgotten that I'm a little bit of a curmudgeon, and I don't really want to promote poetry. I don't think it's for everybody. I think I love poetry, so it's for me. People who love poetry, I want to write for them. I'm not interested in writing for or encouraging my students to write for persons that will never pick up a poetry book. I mean, I don't see any sense in that. Mm-hmm. You have to realize that it's not for everybody. That doesn't make the person for whom it is not a lesser person.
Right, right.
I'm sure there are other obsessions that person entertains and loves pouring over.
Right.
Giving all of his or her or their energies into doing. That's as it should be. So I'm not really a poetry popularizer.
Uh-huh.
And because I have a vision that for people who commit, who see that their vocation is a linguistic vocation, who pore over words and love words, how words open up to other words, how their own small ideas become much larger ideas, and that doesn't end when you pick up when you pick up a book, another book, yet another book, your world just keeps growing.
And for folk who want that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, who have that kind of hunger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I write for them. And someone once asked me who my audience was. I don't think I have an audience. I mean, I'd be surprised if I had an audience. But who do I write for, they ask. And I say, well, I guess I write for the dead poets who taught me how to be a poet.
Hmm.
You know, I became a poet as a beneficiary of having pored over their work.
Right,
And now, in a way, I'm answering back to them. I'm writing back to them things that I hope would please them.
Let's follow that and that turn. And I think, you know, our listeners would be interested.
What, an audience? You say we have an audience?
Well, see, we do. You said you don't have an audience.
Oh,
but actually, here we are.
Yeah.
And by the way, you do have folk who love your work and who collect it and are happy to see the next book come out.
No taste.
Yeah. But let's turn our conversation to talk about, you know, your own work and practice.
Yeah.
You know, what do you do? How and why do you do it? And so you've already touched on this a little bit, but how would you just describe your work as a poet, or maybe a little, this is a little more coarse, but, you know, Scott, what's your job anyhow?
Well, my job is to become, become holy.
And you think poetry is going to help you?
Well, it could, because I've had a sort of God obsession since I was a child. I've mentioned this on a couple occasions. You know, I just vividly remember a moment when I must have been a tiny kid, because we were at the old house that we lived in first, and I was outside the door. The door was closed. I could fit my little feet right there on the threshold of the door. So I must not have been very big, but I just remember looking out into a really crystal clear Tacoma, Washington, winter's night, and seeing all these stars and just saying, you know, said out loud, I love life. I had this sort of wonderful sense of God's closeness. And my answer to that sensation was, or my response to that sensation was to say, I love life. And it's such a vivid moment in my memory.
How old do you think you were?
I must have been 4 or 5.
Mm-hmm.
And
the memory's held fast, and does it hold fast with you as you work and as you write?
I haven't always liked life, but I've always, this base note of joy has been prominent in my psyche, and I think that is what fueled my hunger to kind of get to know God more, and I think that's what we're all called to do, but we all have to find, I guess we can call it a vocation, or the means by which we do that. And for me, it's been languaging, you know, working with words, seeing what comes of my working with words, and glimpsing in that activity, in the very midst of the activity. I'm not even talking about finishing something.
Right,
in the act of making.
Yeah.
You see, and you see, and you see. That kind of pushes me, that it keeps me moving toward God.
So if someone is doing that work with words, that making, but at this point they wouldn't claim any kind of God consciousness, say, do you think, is that work still kind of holy work somehow, or are they making progress? You think so, yeah.
I think, you know, your listeners may not realize this, but we had a conversation not unlike this moments ago.
We did,
room. And it doesn't really matter who you think or what you think your passion is drawing you toward, or your hunger, you know. There's some hunger, variously named, that if we're paying attention will lead us where we probably ought to be, mm-hmm. or at least in the direction we ought to be going.
Well, I respond to that.
Yeah, I don't think you have to name it.
No, I don't think so either. I think the, you know, what you describe happening for you as you're working with words and... Something like that is happening for me in my studio when I'm working with paint and making things. It's not always happening.
No, that's true.
But there's moments, you know, sometimes we call that flow. I don't know if that's quite right, but there are moments when it's very vivid.
Yeah.
So practical questions for you. Just how do you actually get your work done?
Oh, I ignore a lot of things I should be paying attention to.
Now, I think that makes the... poet's vocation very attractive all of a sudden. It's an excuse to avoid responsibility, it sounds like.
Yeah, so it's changed over the years. I mean, currently my wife and I live with 2 Labradors. But, you know, most of my writing happened when we were living with 2 children. And so back in the day, and I learned, you know, I'd mentioned William Stafford's name in a previous conversation we were having with other folks moments ago. And, I learned this from Bill Stafford, because he came to our house when I was working on my PhD, and we had one new baby in the house, and, you know, we were just talking one evening, and I said, geez, I don't know how I'm going to get all this done. And he said, Well, Scotty, I've learned that if you wake up before anyone else does, you have a little time. Or if you go to bed after everyone else has gone to bed, you can get a little bit done. He says, just, you know, expand your day to accommodate a little time without the chores and the busyness. And so when we had the little kids, you know, I just would stay up really late.
I was going to ask you which side of the day you chose. Yeah,
I was better on the end of the day. These days, I do most of my writing in the morning because I don't have but a couple of Labradors Marcia and I take care of pretty early on. I mean, they get us up by 4:30 or 5 every morning, and we get them out on their run, done by 7:30 or 8, and then unless I have other chores I have to do.
Well, I was going to move to that question. You know, I hear it's interesting to hear what people do, and you sometime will hear, you know, a novelist, and she'll say, you know, well, I sit down in my chair with my cup of coffee at 9 o'clock, and I write till noon every day, and I want to key in 500 words, or but do you think about your work in any way like that?
Well,
I mean, a kind of routine or a regimen?
Yeah, no, I have, as I say, it's kind of a routine. I'm not religious about my routine. How's that?
That's good, yeah.
I'm usually writing something by 9, and I'm usually touching on it, you know, till midday. But I'll get up and do other things and come back. I don't plant myself in the chair and stay there.
Waiting for the universe to greet you.
Absolutely. That's a great way to waste a lot of time, is to wait for inspiration. So what I do is I begin my writing by reading. Yes, I had assumed I'd already said that because I say it so often, but we haven't said that.
Right, right. That's important.
And that also happened during the days we had children, you know. Before we had children, I would just, you know, sit in front of a window and think deep thoughts and write them down. And then be embarrassed for them. But once we had kids, I couldn't get to that space except through reading. So when I had my time to write, I would open a book of poems by someone who had faithfully delivered for me in the past.
Uh-huh.
And I would pore over a poem or two until I started responding to it. And so I'd have the book open in one side and my legal pad and my pencil on the other side, and I'd read until I had a response to that, and I'd write something down. And then I'd read until I had another response. And so after a while, I'd have several lines on the paper. I'd put the book down, and I'd start just doing that same sort of reading and responding to my own text until those built out into poems.
Right.
Or at least drafts of poems.
Yeah. Who are the kinds of poets you're drawn? You know, who? Well, not the kinds. Well, so poets are you drawn to? And
well, I have a stack. I think there may be as many as 10 books at a time, and then there are probably 6 or 7 or 8 collected poems that are always on the table. My most recently published book is called Correspondence with My Greeks, and on the cover is a drawing of my face and a side by side with the drawing of C.P. Kavafi, Konstantinos Kavafis, Greek poet from the early 20th century.
Oh, okay.
Writing in Alexandria, Egypt, in that Greek community there. One of the most moving poets in my... So I'll read him. He's always on the table. Kavafis on the table. Wallace Stevens is always on the table. Robert Frost is always on the table. Emily Dickinson is always on the table. Elizabeth Bishop is always on the table. And Richard Howard, one of my mentors, a person I actually met and studied with over the course of years. So these people are always on the table, and then periodically others will come and go. And, you know, there are a lot of great poets writing.
This is a bit of an aside, but I think it fits. An art collector friend of mine, we were once talking, I said, well, you know, how do you decide what art to buy? And he said, well, I only buy artwork from people I know and people I love. He said, and that I hang in my home. And then so every morning when I get up and I walk into, you know, around my home, I'm surrounded by all the people I love.
That's a lovely idea.
It is, isn't it? It sounds a lot like I'm surrounded by the poets I love.
Yeah, they're there always for me.
Yeah.
And there again, you know, we talked about audience. That's really who I write for. I write, they taught me how to do what I do, and I want to sort of write back to them what has come of it.
Yeah. That kind of goes nicely to, I think, a related question. How does community figure in for you, right? So I like this picture of my art collector friend, but I like this picture now I'll have of you surrounded by this community of poets that are important to you. But how about other communities these days in terms of just, you know?
Because the people I mentioned don't come over for dinner.
They don't, But, though it sounds like you could cook a nice meal for them.
They wouldn't. If they could come over, I think they'd be happy.
They'd be happy.
Yeah. I have cooked for Richard Howard, and he loved my cheese souffle.
I mean, in the day-to-day, are there, I'm not asking for names here, but I'm thinking about, as others are listening, how might you encourage people to bring people into their life, and how does that figure in terms of encouragement?
You know, I'm sad to say that I have a lot of good friends, and especially, I mean, all those years in grad school and teaching, I have friends all over the country, really wonderful friends, people I love. I don't see them that often. But now I'm living in the town I grew up in the part of the town I grew up in. The house I grew up in. A lot of the people I grew up with are still around. I get a shout out most times I go to the grocery store, somewhere I run into somebody, and I've had a few of them over for dinner. You know, I don't think many, if any of them, really read my poems or care about my poems.
Yeah.
My brother and his wife are over at the house as often as anybody is. They're just a few miles away, and they're probably the only people that come to the house and read my work. I actually asked my wife on occasion if she's read all of it. I don't think she has.
Well, partly I ask. Some artists, you know, choose to belong to, you know, a writing group, you know, at different ages and stages of life. Or
I'm part of a writing group, but as I mentioned, most of the people in the group are dead. But doesn't mean we don't have a lively conversation.
If you're, you know, working on a piece, who do you want your first readers to be, maybe even before it goes into print?
So I've had some great teachers, and if they were in a position to look at anything, I would love to show Mark Strand, Larry Levis, Andy Dillard, Richard Howard, Michael Mott. I would love to show these people my work in progress. As I mentioned, they're dead.
Right.
I don't have anybody that... This is going to sound very uncharitable, but I don't have anybody I trust like that.
Uh-huh.
But I do have them.
Right.
I still have their voices in my ear. I can look at a thing and I can tell you pretty much what most of each of them would have to say about it. And that all then is internalized and is part of the process of my making a poem.
Yeah, yeah.
I look at a thing and I think about how I've been taught to not do that.
Right.
So I fix it.
Right, right.
But, you know, so they haven't stopped mentoring me. And I just don't happen to have anybody. I mean, I have a lot of poets I love whose work I love. I don't show them my work. They don't show me their work. Mm-hmm. You know, I think we're reciprocally suspicious.
I mean, is this
what
also...
What we can do for one another.
Well, I like the vivid image here of... Yeah. These good mentors you've had, and how
they haven't.
Their mentorship is still daily in play for you. But is it possible that you would you say, well, I've actually, you know, I found my voice, so I'm not looking for other people to help me find. I mean, that whole idea of voice comes up a lot, right?
Well, one might say that about me. People have told me that they hear my voice when they read my poems. I know that from whence that voice comes.
Oh.
And it's like all those people in my head.
Right.
I'm kind of a hybrid version of that crew.
Yeah, right.
And I guess something else, whoever I was to begin with,
right,
and have become, is
so
in the
maybe
mix.
From age 4 or 5 when.
And also, you know, yeah. I'm not only reading poets. I read a lot of theologies, especially patristic theology and texts written by saints of the Eastern Church, and those ideas and some of the phrasing, but mostly the sort of the opening ideas. Have also contributed to the what we would call, I guess, my voice, really, my disposition.
So disposition, good word. I like that. So what's it like when work is going well? Mm-hmm. I'm going to avoid the word you're being productive. I feel nervous about the word productivity or being productive. But what's it like when work is going well? And then maybe what's it like when work is not going well? I don't know if you can think of episodes in your life like that or.
Well, sure. Well, when work is going well, I don't think about it. I just keep doing it until I have to feed the dogs or something, and then I stop doing it. And when work isn't going well, I go make a cup of coffee. Or work isn't going well, I go make a sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just not that big a deal.
Oh,
it's either going well or it's not going well. If it's going well, I'm just writing. And if it's not going well, I think I could use a coffee.
That's good. You hold that so lightly. I mean, you have too, but be in a conversation and they'll talk about writer's block and just this sort of season of desolation and they've lost the muse and will the muse ever return?
I find myself quoting William Stafford a lot today. He also said to me once, or he didn't say this just to me, he wrote it in one of his books about writing. He said, you know, he didn't believe in writer's block. If you think you're experiencing writer's block, just lower your standards. I don't know that I do that, but I think it's good advice. And what I get from that advice is just you're not going to do it all today anyway. Do what you can do today.
Right.
And then come back to that thing tomorrow. Work it over, make it better. And then eventually you can raise the standards again.
Right, right.
And then maybe even meet them.
Our mutual friend, Bruce Herman, the painter, his response to that kind of question, well, I just need to go down in the studio then and push more paint around, and eventually I'll figure out where I'm going. And I actually believe him.
Yeah, Ed Nippers once was talking to me about when he thought he was in a block. He was like working with a canvas and he just had a problem. I don't even know enough about his painting technique to know what the problem might have been, but
maybe getting the figure right.
He registered some problem with a particular part of a figure he was working on, and then periodically during that morning or whenever, he thinking, I need to go to the gallery, because he lives in D.C., so I think the National Gallery. He kept thinking he had to go to the National Gallery. And then he sort of chastened himself because he thought he was just trying to get out of something. So he ignored that impulse, and he kept working on the thing, and it wasn't going anywhere. But he kept thinking, maybe I'll just go to the gallery. And this went on for some time, and eventually he throws everything in. He makes his way to the gallery and takes a turn and goes to a painting and looks at this painting that he'd been thinking about kind of subconsciously. And he sees a solution to his problem. Whatever it was that was stumping him was worked out in such a way that he went right back home and fixed.
And painted it.
Yeah, and did the thing.
Yeah.
You know, I love that kind of answer to writer's block or artist's block or any kind of, is, you know, well, someone's done it, right? Someone's done it. Read it. Read another book. You know, if you can't write, read another book. There are plenty of books. You're not going to run out.
Yeah, sometimes I hear artists, and I'm speaking broadly here, you know, the poets, but, you know, painters too and musicians.
Well, thanks for acknowledging that there's some art involved in the poetry thing.
Well, that was never a question me, Scott. But there's this conversation, well, how much of this is, you know, inspiration and perspiration, right? I don't know if you've probably heard it talked about that way, but the message I mostly get from artist friends, and I think you're describing it here, is it's a matter of sort of sitting down and doing the work.
Yeah. Discipline is
going ahead.
As we call it. Yeah.
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 There's a reason for that. We're students, disciples. And we have a discipline.
Yeah.
And we have to do our exercises.
Yeah, good. Like playing the scales over and over.
I get, yeah.
Yeah.
Not that I'm a musician.
Well, I'm not either, but...
I can play some chords.
Musician friends tell me this, that they have to practice the scales every day. Sort of heading to the end of our conversation here, a big topic I want to make sure that we talk about is, you know, I read your work, others read your work. It's deeply spiritual work, it seems to me. Often explicitly religious in nature, not always, but I just wonder, how has your Christian faith and these days your Orthodox faith figured into your work as a poet? Both maybe in the regular day-to-day working on it, but, you know, with the long view, too.
I'm going to use some of what we've already said as and then expand upon it. I think that the love of God led to a love of language as a way to know God better, and that the work that has then come about through that has kind of led me to a disposition, an understanding, a glimpse that God is absolutely there, and making the work, honoring people around me the way I honor the work, that's also kind of an issue for me. Is, you know, I guess there used to be a time when if I was insulted, I'd feel like I'd have to answer in kind. You know, if someone treated me badly, I felt angry about it. But then the prayer life, which is also, we didn't get around to this, and I'll try to make this quick, but...
Yeah.
I used to resist the notion that poetry and prayer were, he's like, very much alike.
Right.
I resist that less and less because I do know that when I'm making a poem, I'm quieting in a way and attending to what's before me. And as my prayer life has evolved and developed, I now think that way about prayer. My favorite times in prayer happen when, after I've recited, I have a prayer book and a rule of prayer, and I say those. But the best time comes when I just lean into who's there, and the words are kind of beside the point. It's because the prayer has afforded me a kind of stillness and a level of attention to what's before me, invisibly, but there. And so that's how my vocation as a poet has kind of incrementally led me into prayer, and the prayer has led me into being the kind of person who now, when I'm offended or insulted or hurt in some way, I'm so sure of God's presence at this point that when that happens, instead of feeling angry toward that person, I feel embarrassed for him. Because I know who he's just done that in front of, someone who loves me very much. And so it's not anger, it's like loving the enemy is now, I see how that works.
It's a beautiful description of how writing practice and spiritual practice begin to converge on one another. And I've always been a little bit cautious, right, about saying, well,
it's good to be
making
cautious.
Art is prayer. Well, yeah. I'm not sure that it always is, but I think the way you just described it is really...
It can assist us toward the real thing, which is the prayer and the path toward becoming like God.
Right. And I think when you describe it that way, it's very compelling. And
well, you should listen to me more often.
Maybe if you come back, Scott, I can. Yeah.
We'll see about it.
Thanks for a good conversation.
Well, thank you. Appreciate this very much.
Thank you for tuning into the Upwards podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation. For more information about the S.L. Brown Foundation and Upper House, please visit slbf.org. Go in peace to be a light on our campuses, in our churches, and in our businesses so that all may flourish.